animal control's visit had been timed during such a busy afternoon. As she got closer, she heard Tootie shouting, "Dougie Hazard, don't make me call your mama on you!" Dougie Hazard's heavy Adam's apple made him look like a cartoon buzzard. He was backing toward the truck with Arlo in his arms, which was wise, considering the rake. Tootie might have been old, but she had a considerable amount of upper body strength.
"Now, Miss Tootie, I know you take real good care of your animals. I have no objections to how you keep them, but once a complaint has been filed with my office, I can't just ignore it. That's the kind of thing that will get me fired."
"What's going on here? Put Arlo down now," Margot demanded, prying the rake out of Tootie's grasp. "Really, Tootie, you're going to give yourself a stroke."
"He's taking Arlo!" Tootie shouted.
"Can you explain why?" Margot asked, turning on Dougie. "You can see that the dogs are all in good shape. They have clean conditions and ample food, and they're obviously getting plenty of exercise and socialization."
"Miss Tootie has 13 dogs in her possession, which is one over the limit set by the county ordinance against hoarding," Dougie told Margot,
hitching his loose belt over his narrow hips with one hand as he struggled with the wriggling dog.
"That means I have to take one to the county shelter. And since Miss Tootie can't provide any papers proving this one's had his shots, I'm taking him in."
"Is it a kill shelter?" Margot muttered out of the side of her mouth. Tootie nodded, glaring at Dougie. "After 72 hours? Arlo squirmed in Dougie's arms, whining pitifully. Margot shot Dougie a venomous glare.
"Really? You don't feel bad about this at all?" "I don't make the rules," Dougie protested.
"Well, the rule doesn't apply anyway, because that dog isn't Tootie's, it's mine," she said, taking Arlo from his grasp. Arlo's claws dug into her arms as he scrambled up her body. Also, she was pretty sure that warm, wet spot spreading against her silk blouse wasn't sweat. Still, Margot didn't want to imagine how Tootie would react if she lost Arlo. Or really, how Margot would feel if she lost Arlo. She'd gotten accustomed to him finding a way into her home and onto her couch. He was like a warm, furry worry stone.
"He's yours," Dougie asked, in a tone that clearly communicated his desire to call bullshit on Margot's claim.
"Sure is," Margot said, willing herself not to shudder when Arlo's wet nose wedged under her chin. As much as she liked Arlo, that didn't make that sensation any more comfortable.
"Good boy."
Dougie's thin, graying eyebrows lifted.
"Do you have any vet bills or paperwork to prove he's yours?"
Margot glanced at Tootie, who subtly shook her head. "No, he's a stray. I just found him in the parking lot at the food carnival the other day. I haven't had a chance to file the paperwork yet," Margot lied smoothly. "I'll be sure to do that as soon as possible. Surely you can't punish a good Samaritan for not having time in her busy schedule to run down to the courthouse, can you?" Dougie frowned at her.
"Put him down. Walk about 10 paces and call him to you."
"What?"
"Prove that he's yours," Dougie said.
"Call him."
"This isn't a scene from Annie," Margot protested. "I haven't had time to bond with him yet. And I'm just calling him Arlo because he didn't have any tags and it was the first name I could come up with. I don't know what he answers to."
"If you want me to go, call the dog," Dougie told her.
"Fine." Margot handed the dog to Tootie and walked 10 steps away. Tootie whispered in Arlo's ear while Margot dropped into a crouch.
"Come here, Arlo. Come here,"
Margot said in her best doggy voice. Tootie put Arlo on the ground. But for once, instead of instantly invading Margot's personal space, he sat on his butt, staring at her with his head cocked to the side.
"Uh-huh,"
Dougie snorted.
"Come on, Arlo. Come here, sweet Dougie,"
Margot cooed. Arlo stayed seated on his furry butt.
"Arlo,"
she grumbled through gritted teeth. She rolled her eyes and smacked her hands against her legs in frustration. Suddenly, Arlo perked up and came running. Dougie's jaw dropped, but not nearly as low as Margot's. She let the dog paw at her knees, but wary of further damage to her clothes, didn't pick him up. Arlo circled around to Margot's left hip and sniffed at her pocket with interest.
"You see there?" Tootie cackled. "That there's Margot's dog. I tried to tell you, but you wouldn't listen."
Margot blanched as a small plastic baggie slipped out of her pocket, and Arlo clamped his teeth on it. It was a sample she'd picked up at the jerky store. Mako shark with lemon and ginger flavoring, thinking that Duffy would get a kick out of it. She made a discreet grab for the jerky bag and stood, tucking it behind her back so Dougie couldn't see the meaty treat that had lured Arlo to her.
"Sit, Arlo," she told him firmly.
Arlo whined a bit, but planted his furry butt on the ground.
"Fine,"
Dougie muttered, scribbling angrily on his clipboard.
"But you will get his papers in order by the next time I come out here. And Miss Tootie, you've been skating the line for too long, making me a laughingstock at county commission meetings."
"Oh, I don't make you a laughingstock, Dougie. You do that well enough on your own,"
Tootie shot back. Margot nudged Tootie's ribs with her elbow. Dougie grunted and waved her off as he stomped toward his truck. He peeled out of the driveway with the dog pack chasing the tires at a respectable distance.
"Oh, y'all stop that," Tootie yelled, calling them back. "You don't chase stupid. It will find you eventually. Go on home now."
The pack stopped the chase and took off running toward EJJ and Tootie's cabin. All except for Arlo, who seemed to assume that his fraudulent adoption was actually happening, and planted himself at Margot's feet.
"Big lot of fuss over nothing," Tootie said with a sigh.
Margot asked, "Why didn't you just go get the dog's paperwork in the first place, Tootie?"
"You heard him. I'm over the county limit," she sniffed.
"I'm old. I'm not stupid." "So when do you think Dougie might come back to check on my completely fabricated story?"
"Oh, who knows? Dougie's harmless. Under normal circumstances, he'd probably just forget about it. But I think it's Sarah Lee that's got him all stirred up. She's been jawing to whoever will listen about how you're ruining the Founders Festival."
"What does that have to do with anything?"
"Sarah Lee was Dougie's high school girlfriend. He never quite got over it, and she knows it. And she can't strike back directly at you, so she's trying to get to you through me."
Margot's brow furrowed. "High school romances run deep around here, don't they? So if I keep working with the planning committee, there's a chance you could lose your dogs? Should I tell Kyle that I need to back off from the festival?"
"Oh, honey, I have a long-standing feud with animal control. They're always threatening me with something. Don't let it rattle you."
"I'm not used to being targeted by municipal agencies. I am comfortable with my being rattled." Margot propped her hands on her hips, staring down at Arlo.
"You're not sleeping at my house. My shoes will remain unchewed."
Arlo dropped his head to his paws, whining pitifully as he gave her literal puppy eyes. Margot rolled her eyes, and in doing so, caught sight of the shabbier yellow house.
"Hey, Tootie,
the house at the end of the row, the yellow one with the green roof, who lives there?" Tootie pursed her lips.
"Well, you did, hon."
"I'm sorry?" Aunt Tootie walked toward the unkempt cabin.
"That was the cabin that your dad built for your mama. They moved in right after the wedding."
Margot absorbed this new piece of information.
"But he doesn't live there anymore? It looks like it hasn't been kept up in years."
"Right after your mama left, he moved into the sleeping cubby at the funeral home."
"He's been sleeping at the funeral home for 30 years? She exclaimed.
"He couldn't sleep at the house anymore," she said. "Said it was too quiet. We tried to keep it up for him. Leslie and I do what we can so the inside doesn't get too musty. But he doesn't want us putting on a new roof or carpet
I think part of him was afraid you might not recognize it when you came home.
I didn't recognize it, she said, shaking her head. This doesn't look at all familiar. She stared at the forlorn little cabin, its windows reflecting nothing, like blank doll's eyes. There was no life inside this house. There hadn't been life there for years. And she didn't feel the faintest tug at her memory while staring at it. Shouldn't she be able to remember the first place she called home?
You want to go inside? Tootie asked. I have a spare key.
Margot shook her head. I think I'm going to go see Kyle. Talk to him about this new development with Dougie. And then I need to look up how to file a dog license.
Oh, honey, don't worry about it. I have the papers in my desk at home.
Of course you do, Margot murmured. She patted Arlo's head and walked toward her truck. She paused mid-step. Tootie, when you decided where I was supposed to sleep, why did you put me in Mary Ann's old cabin instead of the one that belonged to my parents?
Well, first of all, I wanted someone close enough to hear me calling for help when I inevitably fall and break my hip when EJJ is out of the house. Stan's old cabin is too far away for that. And I did it because I didn't think you were ready to face that memory head on yet. You and Stan are still circling each other like cranky bears. You need some time.
Thank you, Tootie.
But mostly the hip thing. Those Life Alert commercials scare the hell out of me.
Kyle sat at his kitchen table, iced tea glass sweating between his hands as Margot gave him an account of Dougie's vigilant defense of animal licensing at Sarah Lee's behest. Margot had obtained his address from Mary Ann, because in small towns everybody knows everybody's address. The Archer home was an adorable, recently built Cape Cod salt box on the water, with blue shutters and enormous pots of mums growing on either side of the front door. Even from the driveway, Margot could see a dock stretching out behind the house. The wooden sailboat was tethered to the dock, bobbing lazily in the waves. Hazel had opened the door, wearing a rainbow-striped shirt with a chimpanzee on the chest and electric blue leggings paired with silver tap shoes. She hadn't greeted Margot in any way, simply yelled for her father and skulked off to her room. The inside of the house was a little less well-kept than the yard. It was clean, but cluttered, with dolls, dressed like tiny drag queens, and coloring books littering the polished wood floor of the large living room. The sofa was huge and squishy-looking, made of a sturdy dark blue cotton. Paperback detective novels and academic journals were piled high on the coffee table. The degrees missing from Kyle's office were found here. A bachelor's in education from the University of Virginia, a master's from some private college in New York she'd never heard of. Big picture windows framed a beautiful view of the lake, but the long blue curtains that accented them could use a good washing. Overall, the effect was cozy, but it made Margot's hands itch to sort everything into some semblance of order. Framed pictures were scattered over every spare surface, mostly family shots showing both girls at much younger stages, beaming from the arms of a beautiful, dark-haired woman with laughing brown eyes. This must have been Maggie, she mused, noting with a twinge of shameful envy the easy, joyful grin on the younger version of Kyle's face as he stood with his arms wrapped around his wife. They looked like such a happy family. Even shy, solemn Hazel seemed to glow in the way only settled, happy children could. The only dark spot was a baby picture of June, dimpled and chubby, cradled in the arms of a thinner, paler Maggie. Kyle was smiling at the camera, but there were dark circles under his eyes and pinched lines around his mouth. This seemed to be the last picture they'd taken before they lost Maggie. It was easier to grasp what Kyle had lost, and somehow harder, standing here in the home of a dead woman. Was she wrong to think about Kyle as a potential partner when she couldn't guarantee him anything? What about his girls? She'd never dated a father before. and it was simple to say it didn't matter when those girls weren't in the next room with all their expectations and adorable eyes. The kitchen, where Kyle had led her after he'd recovered from the shock of Margot showing up at his door, was equally homey. From the carefully coordinated spring green tile and curtains and countertops, there was a sense that at one point someone, Margot guessed Kyle's late wife, had very patiently decorated this kitchen to be a magazine-perfect, heart-of-the-home type room. But since that time, the space had been filmed over with number one dad mugs and crayon drawings secured with alphabet magnets. It smelled of some buttery concoction that was bubbling in the oven. It was everything her mother detested in a home, in that there was evidence that people, and horrors, children, lived there. Margot shook her head, somehow feeling guilty for thinking of her mother here, in the home of a woman who had loved her child so much she had literally died for her. So she focused on explaining Sarah Lee and her weird struggle for power over what amounted to nothing. I can't believe Sarah Lee would do this. Who tries to steal someone's dog because they're threatened over a community festival? It's like starting a knife fight over a telethon. It doesn't make any sense. I can give her kids detention, Kyle told her, grimacing. And headlines. I have that kind of power. While I appreciate your willingness to take my anger out on small children, my conscience demands that I say no, she said, sipping her iced tea. It was unsweetened, and therefore didn't make her throat close up when she drank it. I could just talk to Sarah Lee about her Game of Thrones-style attempts to wrestle control of Founder's Day from you. I don't need you to fight my battles for me. I didn't come here to tattle on her, she told him. I just wanted to warn you that if you receive any mysterious emails from me claiming that I want male strippers and a simulated snow ski ramp in the town square, get a verbal confirmation. Well, the head lice and detention offer stands. Sarah Lee's oldest son cut 4 inches off of Hazel's ponytail on the first day of school. He has payback coming. How do you deal with this? Margot asked. All the petty squabbles and backbiting. Kyle rose and grabbed a bag of vegetables from his freezer. He put them in the microwave and set the timer. You're telling me that you've never dealt with petty squabbles or backbiting in the junior league set? Yeah, but it was over... important things? Well, more money. Yeah. There's no way for me to finish that sentence without sounding like a pompous ass, Margot conceded. Not really, he teased, smirking at her. I am never going to fit in here, she sighed. And a few weeks ago, that really wouldn't have bothered me all that much. And now? Well, it doesn't bother me a lot. But it bothers me more than I'm comfortable with, she muttered. He grinned at her and bent to remove a casserole dish from the oven. She couldn't make out the contents of the steaming dish, but she could see that it was crusted over with crispy-looking crushed cornflakes. I'm assuming that the programs and presentations are coming along on the kids' end because I can handle a lot of crises. But mass stage fright from a bunch of third graders is sort of outside the realm of problems I can fix with a sewing kit and a sense of determination, she said. We're on track, I promise, he said. I have a little more control over the staff since I can fire them if they don't do what I tell them. I can't fire parent volunteers. Margot lifted a brow. Can't you? June burst into the kitchen in a flurry of yellow tulle.
Daddy, I'm starving, she proclaimed dramatically, sagging against the fridge.
The bright yellow tutu she was wearing was offset by a pair of purple and black striped tights and a blue Monster Math Squad t-shirt.
Oh, June, I don't know how you're still alive after only consuming 3 packs of Cheez-Its the moment you hit the door after school.
June's jaw dropped, her big brown eyes wide with shock.
Yes, I know about the 2 extra packs, because I am Dad, and I see all.
June turned her gaze to Margot, who grimaced.
I have no input into this situation at all,
June crawled into Margot's lap and put a hand on either side of her face.
Hi, grocery store lady.
Small children were not at all respectful of personal space bubbles. Margot pursed her lips, if for no other reason than to keep June's thumbs out of her mouth. You can call me Margot.
Where do you live? How old are you? Are you married?
I live on the MacReady compound. It's not nice to ask a lady how old she is, and no, I'm not married. June gasped.
You live with the funeral people? That's so creepy.
June, Kyle said, his tone a little sharp. No, she's right, Margot said. It is occasionally creepy.
You talk funny, June told her. Where are you from?
I'm from Chicago, she replied.
Do we sound funny to you?
June asked, with her father's twinkle in her big, dark eyes. Margot nodded. A little bit, but not like most of the people in town. June asked,
Are you here to see me?
Absolutely. Who else would I be here to see?
I like your hair. It's even lighter than mine. Is this your real hair, or do you dye it like my teacher?
She said, taking the nearest of Margot's loose locks and stretching it across her own forehead, as if she was trying on a lighter shade of blonde. Margot tried to ignore her immediate internal warnings about head lice and various germs that June could be carrying home from school. But she did gently tug her hair out of June's grip. And Kyle had brought up the head lice, specifically. It's real, Margot said. But I do add some highlights every once in a while, just to keep things interesting.
Ms. Malcolm tells the other teachers that's what she's doing when she stands out in the halls. But she leaves on Friday with a bunch of gray and always comes back without any gray hair. So I think she's doing something else.
You are very observant, Margot told her.
But you probably shouldn't say anything like that in front of other grown-ups.
June preened at the compliment and seemed to forget the rest.
I like you. Are you going to stay for dinner?
Oh, no. I just came over to talk to your daddy for a second. I should be going.
No, stay,
June insisted. Margot glanced at Kyle, shaking her head. I couldn't.
Stay,
June growled, flopping her arms over Margot's shoulders and sagging against her.
What is happening?
Margot whispered, awkwardly patting June's back.
How do you feel about macaroni and cheese?
Kyle asked, brows lifted as he watched his daughter. The microwave dinged. He pulled out the bag of vegetables and tossed it back and forth between his hands.
And broccoli?
I like macaroni and cheese, she said. No comment on the broccoli because I don't want to be a bad influence on your children.
Thank you,
he said.
June, why don't you go tell your sister it's time for dinner?
June detached herself from Margot's neck. She pointed her finger in Margot's face.
Don't move.
I wouldn't dream of it. And wash your hands, Kyle called after her as June ran out of the room. With soap.
As an afterthought, he added,
And water.
Is the tutu a fashion choice or is there a costume involved? Margot asked.
The tutus are an after-school-only accessory, he said. We have a whole policy about it. We had to write one after the Great Tutu War of 2015.
I think I saw something about that on the news.
Many lives were lost.
I don't have to stay if it's going to make you uncomfortable, she said. I didn't mean to intrude. I didn't even think about it being dinner time.
No, you should stay, he said. June gets something in her head, expecting that it's going to go a certain way, and then she gets rattled if it changes. As far as the girls know, you're a friend who's helping me plan something for the school. And if you wouldn't mind, I would like to keep it that way. I don't introduce them to women I spend time with outside of the house.
Understood. I am a mere distant acquaintance.
What can I do to help?
Well, my cooking skills, such as they are, have been exhausted by this feast you see before you.
But could you set the table?
The dishes and silverware are out on the counter.
I'll grab an extra plate.
June returned, waving her hands in the air and declaring them clean. She helped Margot put four place settings on the table while Kyle poured milk for the girls. Hazel slunk into the kitchen, watching Margot warily. It seemed the older Archer girl didn't like last-minute changes either. She sat down and began quietly picking at her dinner. Margot felt very awkward, sitting down with the little family. This was not her place, with Kyle's children enjoying a home-cooked meal. She decided she would eat as quickly as possible and then make her excuses to run back home. Kyle's baked macaroni was very serviceable, but not much compared to the casseroles her family had left in her fridge over the last few weeks. Still, he'd made sure there was something green on the plate, and the girls were drinking milk without complaint. Clearly, he was doing something right. June kept up a steady stream of chatter about her school day, the mean boy in her class who stole a classmate's lunchtime cupcake, the picture of a dog she'd drawn in art.
"Daddy, can we hang my picture of the dog on the fridge?" June asked.
"Sure," he said, glancing at the crowded fridge.
"We may have to cull out some of your earlier works. Your rainbow period is probably going to go."
"That's fine," she sighed. "Because having a picture of a dog is as close as we're going to get to one right now."
"Well played, June," Kyle said, frowning, turning to Margot.
"The girls have been doing extra chores and keeping their grades up to prove that they're ready to have a dog."
"We've been waiting forever," June groaned.
6 weeks, Kyle told Margot.
She wondered if she should bring up Aunt Tootie's abundance of dogs. But she was sure Kyle wouldn't appreciate her interjecting in this conversation. So instead, she said,
"My mom wouldn't let me have a dog when I was growing up. She was allergic."
"My mommy died,"
Hazel said, finally looking up at her as if Margot's response was some sort of personality test. Kyle went tense. And for a second, Margot got a glimpse of that miserable stranger she'd seen wandering around town. His lips pinched together, and he turned his eyes on Margot, pleading and apologizing all at once. He looked so miserable that Margot couldn't find it in her to be irritated by Hazel's indirect challenge. She was a little girl who was sad and angry over an absent parent, and that was something Margot knew something about. She took a deep breath through her nose and focused on keeping her voice calm.
"I know. I'm sorry about that. Do you want to talk about it?"
"Not really,"
Hazel said, stabbing at her macaroni with her fork.
"Okay, then."
Margot scooped up a bit of broccoli into her mouth, wincing at the bitter green. She didn't care if it made her a giant child. She would never like the stuff.
"Is your mommy alive?"
Hazel asked. Trying to demonstrate good table manners, Margot dabbed at her mouth with a napkin before answering.
"No, she isn't. She passed away 3 years ago."
Hazel stared at her long and hard, as if she thought Margot was lying. When Margot didn't blink, a tiny crack seemed to appear in Hazel's icy exterior, and she nodded.
"I'm sorry."
"Thank you."
"Do you miss her very much?"
Margot tried not to let too much of a conversational lapse go by, because that would be telling.
"Sometimes I do."
"Do you cry?"
Hazel asked, sounding childlike for the first time since Margot had met her.
"Sometimes I cry, and Dad says that's okay."
"Once in a while," Margot admitted.
"And however you feel about it is okay." "And how do you feel?"
Hazel asked. Margot's mouth dropped open, unable to find a child-appropriate answer to a very loaded question. Okay, you have mined all of the personal information I'm going to let you try to get out of our dinner guest, Kyle interjected, his bearded cheeks flushing. What's next? Her Apple ID password? PIN numbers?
No one says PIN numbers, Dad, Hazel cried. Everything is done with PayPal now.
Kids grow up too fast, Margot said, grateful for the break in the conversational tension. Kyle muttered,
preaching to the choir.
After dinner, there was a nightly routine of baths and homework checks and complicated preventative tangle care to make hairstyles easier in the morning. Margot excused herself from this scene before she was asked to braid, a skill she'd never managed to pick up. June was loath to let her go, attempting to cling to Margot's leg as she walked into the living room. Hazel wasn't quite as clingy, but her chilly reception had thawed just a little bit. Kyle walked Margot to the door, while his daughters scraped their plates into the garbage.
I'm sorry the girls brought up your mom. I'm sure that was awkward and painful. And I'm sorry about asking you to be remote. But I don't think any of us is ready for someone new to...
Oh, no, it was fine. Thank you for dinner.
If I've learned anything from all this, it's that you don't try to gloss over grief.
I wasn't very close to my mom, she said. The more I find out about her from people here, the more I understand why we weren't close.
Well, if you ever want to talk about it.
I can guarantee that I won't, she told him, edging toward the open front door. She stepped out into the still warm evening air, grateful for the bit of breeze coming off the lake. Kyle's head cocked, and his mouth opened as if he was about to ask her an extremely personal question. But Hazel yelled from the kitchen,
Dad! June hid all of her broccoli in her napkin again!
Margot burst out laughing, her nose bumping against Kyle's chin. He groaned, his hands coming up to slide around her shoulders and press her close in a quick hug.
I'm sorry.
Duty calls, she said, smiling. Good night.
Duty calls, he agreed,
pressing his forehead against hers. He sniffed, separating from her and shouting,
June, sit back down and prepare for a double helping of broccoli for your dessert.
Aw, Dad!
No sweets. We're talking total ice cream lockdown, Kyle called. Don't make me get the kale.
No!
Chapter 11. In the spirit of cooperation, Margot had arrived at the Founders Festival Parents Work Day, also known as Saturday morning at the elementary school gym, with her best smile and her brand new glue gun. Alas, her enthusiasm to help the locals put together booths and handicrafts was not returned. First, Jimmy Greenway met her at the door and tried to tell her that the PTA officers were holding an official closed meeting. But Sweet Johnny waved her in cheerfully.
Hey, Shug,
Sweet Johnny cried, throwing an arm around her.
I'm so glad you're here, because we can't seem to get the easels to stay upright without super gluing them. The flyers are printed on the wrong color paper. And Sarah Lee called all of the information booth volunteers and told them that they're not needed. And I'm having to make a lot of apology phone calls.
Margot sighed. The board had agreed to establish Ask Me Anything booths staffed by volunteers on every corner to help tourists navigate the festival. Sarah Lee hadn't seen the point in them since
everybody around here knows everybody anyway.
Okay, one thing at a time. How bad are the flyers? Could we use them even if they're on the wrong color paper? Sweet Johnny pulled an example out of her back pocket. It was printed on dark blue paper, so the black print was barely readable, even up close. Margot shook her head. So, no. Sweet Johnny muttered,
Sarah Lee insisted that dark blue would show up best on bulletin boards. I bought some lighter paper at the office supply warehouse.
Does Mr. Archer mind if we use the school's copy room to make some replacement flyers? Across the gym, Kyle was nailing together booths with some of the other dads. Between the beard,
the white V-neck t-shirt and the hammer in his hand. He looked like a commercial for extremely flattering jeans. As if he could hear her thinking dirty thoughts about his denim wear, Kyle turned and waved. She waggled her fingers.
"Yeah, Mr. Archer said we could use his copy code,"
Sweet Johnny said.
He was very sweet about it.
"Great. I'll just go get started," Margot said.
"Oh, no need,"
Mr. Greenway said, holding up a thick stack of light blue flyers advertising the festival.
"I just made the copies. My old copy code still works, you know."
"Thank you, Mr. Greenway," Margot said through gritted teeth. She turned to Sweet Johnny. "Okay, what about the easels? What can I do to help there?" Sarah Lee sidled up to Margot with a sly smirk on her face.
"Don't bother. My Robbie put them together. Some things just need a little force so they can find their place."
Margot sneered at Sarah Lee.
"Gee, thanks, Sarah Lee."
She turned to Sweet Johnny, who was watching the exchange with an alarmed expression. "If you give me the contact list for the Ask Me Anything volunteers, I'll call them and explain that they are needed, despite some misguided claims to the contrary. I'm used to making professional-grade apologies for other people's screw-ups."
"Oh, we don't need you for that."
A skinny brunette with a startling amount of red highlights piped up from behind Sarah Lee.
"I already took care of it."
Margot's mouth dropped open. Were these people seriously conspiring to keep her from helping with a community festival? Did they not have better uses for their time? Margot glanced at Mr. Greenway, who seemed to be lording his ability to make copies at will over Kyle. No, apparently they did not.
"How did you even know to do that, Katie Beth?"
Sweet Johnny asked.
"I didn't ask anybody to make those calls. How did you know what to say?"
"Sarah Lee told me what was needed," Katie Beth protested. "She's in charge, isn't she?"
"No, she's not,"
Sweet Johnny cried.
"Mr. Archer brought Margot in because nothing was getting done. Because we keep arguing over silly things, like a bunch of dang children."
"Look, it really doesn't matter who's in charge," Margot said. "I'm only here to help. We're all here for the same reason, which is to make the festival as successful as possible and help bring visitors into the town."
"Well, we don't see the point in you being here,"
Sarah Lee shot back.
"We don't know you. You don't know anything about this town, and you don't even have kids at this school. You know, you really have to be a mother to help out around here. Otherwise, you're just in the way."
"If you think childlessness is my soft underbelly, you are jabbing at the wrong spot," Margot said with a snort. Sarah Lee rolled her eyes. "And sending the dog catcher to Aunt Tootie's house? That's Bush League. I'm not scared of you. I'm not going to be intimidated away from helping just because it makes you unhappy."
"Look, you're terrible at this.
I'm not saying this to hurt you, you just are. Mr. Archer wouldn't have called me in otherwise. I don't care who gets the credit. Take all the credit as far as I'm concerned. But I refuse to let this thing fall flat because you're too short-sighted to realize when you're in over your head. There's one voice that matters here, one directive, and it's mine. And if you have a problem with it, there's the door."
"You can't throw me out of a volunteer work day,"
Sarah Lee shot back. Margot smiled brightly. "Watch me." Sarah Lee hissed, her asymmetrical hair clinging to her left cheek.
"You're crazy, just like your daddy."
Margot's eyes narrowed.
"What's going on here?" Kyle asked.
Sarah Lee's expression turned all peaches and cream.
"Just a little debate about who does what."
"That's right, just a little difference of opinion," Margot said. Her hand had twitched around her glue gun like Clint Eastwood's in a spaghetti western. Sarah Lee flinched, but Margot merely smirked at her.
"I'll just go see if Robbie needs any help,"
Sarah Lee simpered, as she tottered off toward a man who looked like a jock gone to seed. Sarah Lee's supporters peeled away, leaving Margot with Sweet Johnny and Kyle.
"Why do I feel like I missed something important?" Kyle asked.
I've never seen anyone talk to Sarah Lee that way. Not even when we were kids, Sweet Johnny whispered. She's not nearly as scary as she thinks she is, Margot assured her. I just can't believe she's putting this much energy into excluding me from the Founders Festival. It's hardly the Field Museum Gala.
Well, I don't know what that is, but you need to watch Sarah Lee. She's mean as hell when you cross her.
Sweet Johnny cast an apologetic look at Kyle.
Sorry. I know you have to work with her for the PTA. I don't want to put you in an awkward position.
Oh, no. She's awful, Kyle agreed. And Sweet Johnny's right. She fights dirty. You saw what she did with Tootie's dogs. Last year, Ike's wife demanded to see the reports for the school's Christmas wrap fundraiser, and the Rise and Shine got 10 health department complaints called in on them in the next week. Margot frowned.
Did Sarah Lee ever turn the fundraiser reports over?
Kyle shrugged. I had to make my own breakfast for more than a week until Ike got the mess straightened out. That whole time is one big blur.
Several days later, after Margot had removed most of the poster board glitter out of her hair, she shuffled down the dock toward the snack shack in a distinct funk. Not even the sparkle of the early autumn sun on the lake could cheer her. She slumped into the shack, sliding onto one of the stools at the counter and balanced her chin on her hand. The snack shack was a cozy little space, decorated in red vinyl and early Coca-Cola memorabilia. The chalkboard behind the counter listed the deep-fried specials of the day. Margot had come to worship at this altar to cholesterol, hoping it would keep her from falling into some sort of vocational depression. Leslie was standing at an enormous bubbling cauldron of oil, deftly turning some golden brown lumps over with a pair of chopsticks. Donna was sitting at the counter, sipping a cup of coffee.
Hey, Aunt Leslie, Aunt Donna.
Hey there, Donna said. You look like a freshly smacked ass.
What is wrong with you?
Margot asked, shaking her head.
Why the long face, Shug?
Leslie asked gently, plucking the lumps from their fry bath and popping them onto a plate.
Well, I got a call back on one of the resumes I sent out, Margot said,
watching as Leslie sprinkled powdered sugar on the plate and slid it in front of her.
But that should be good news, right? It gets you out of town, and that's what you want,
said Stan, as he slid onto the stool at her right. Margot could hear the intentional gentling of his tone, as if he was struggling not to sound judgmental.
I need a refill for the coffee vats, Les. The Brooks visitation is starting up in 20 minutes.
Margot's lips pinched together. Damn it. Why hadn't she heard Stan following her out on the deck? He wasn't exactly stealthy. And while she hadn't wandered to the snack shack looking for a sympathetic ear, she would rather lean on Leslie's shoulder without Stan around to hear about her latest round of humiliation. His knowing what had just happened would somehow make it that much worse.
No problem,
Donna said, as Leslie set about making her specialty sludge in an industrial-sized coffee brewer.
Margot was just about to tell me why she looks like somebody just gave her socks for Secret Santa.
I did that one time, woman, Stan said. Bob told me you were running low on socks.
Margot snorted.
What's wrong, girl?
Stan asked, in a tone far gentler than he'd ever used in her presence.
You're looking pretty down in the mouth for someone who just got a job offer.
Margot pressed her fingertips between her scrunched brows.
I didn't get a job offer.
Then why did they call you back? Donna asked.
Margot shoved her hands through her loose blonde hair. She would not cry in front of her father. She might cry later, in her bathtub, drinking off-brand Pinot Noir from a solo cup. But she would not cry now. Even if it meant staring at the ceiling and pretending that her contacts were dry.
I got a call back from Soiree. A really great company in New York. I mean, one of my pie-in-the-sky dream jobs that I didn't think I had a shot at, but I applied for because I had nothing to lose. They sent me an email yesterday and asked me to set up a Skype session this afternoon.
I cleared it with EJJ, and I set up the webcam on my desk so I could look all professional and impressive. And when I opened my chat window, I thought it was sort of strange that there were 6 people sitting in the room staring at the monitor. I mean, sometimes you have panel interviews when you're applying at some of the larger firms, but none of the people on the screen looked old enough to be managers or partners. Bethany, the recruiter who emailed me, wasn't on camera, but she started asking me questions. They were normal interview questions at first, my educational background, my internships, early work history. Margot pressed her forehead into her hands. And then Bethany started asking about the greenhouse gala, asking me what I thought led to the crisis and what I would do differently now to prevent the same thing from happening. I thought it was normal for her to ask about it. I mean, I wasn't surprised they'd heard about the flamingo incident. And I didn't blame them for wanting to know whether I'd learned from it if they were going to hire me. But then the off-camera woman started asking the people sitting in front of the camera where they thought I'd gone wrong, how they would have handled it differently, and what sort of office policies could be written to prevent a disaster like this in the future. She was using me as a teaching tool for her underlings. I was giving a TED talk without even realizing it.
Oh, honey, that's awful, Leslie said.
I interrupted their brutal postmortem of my every decision and asked whether this was standard interview procedure. And Bethany laughed. She said she thought my application was a joke, that there was no way I really thought I would be hired on to their company after what I'd done, and she thought I understood that this was a learning opportunity for her employees. Donna frowned.
Tell you what, if anyone asks where me and Duffy are tomorrow, tell them we're on an all-day charter and don't offer any extra details.
Why? Margot asked. So we have an alibi when that snotty bitch's office burns down, Donna said with a shrug. As much as I appreciate the offer of carefully orchestrated arson, that won't be necessary.
Oh, that's okay. We can downgrade to filling their office with bees, rubbing every toilet seat with poison ivy, hiding a dead bass under a couch cushion in What's-Her-Face's office so it will stink for weeks and she won't be able to figure out why.
Margot glanced at Stan and Leslie, neither of whom seemed fazed by Donna's speedy list of disturbing revenge tactics. Again, thank you, but no, I went back and checked my emails with Bethany and realized she hadn't called it an interview. She called it a session. So I can't even get upset with them.
Well, sure you can, Stan said, frowning. They acted like assholes. You can get mad at assholes. Even Tootie Turn the Other Cheek MacReady accepts that.
Margot groaned. I think I was more embarrassed than anything else. No, wait. I'm angry, too. You know what really makes me angry? I'm angry because those snot-nosed little interns were picking apart my work and my decisions like they could have done any better under the circumstances. Like I could have psychically detected the chef's intention to serve the mayor's wife an allergen, and then incinerated the shrimp tower with the power of my mind. Margot sighed. No, that's not it. I'm angry because I let my guard down. I walked right into a humiliating trap and didn't even realize it. I used to be much more cynical. I had the detachment that would have protected my feelings in a case like this. I wouldn't have fallen for vague, misleading language. And even if I did, I wouldn't have let it bother me so much. I think living out in the country is making me soft.
Not soft, Leslie insisted. Softer, maybe.
But you're still plenty cynical, sweetheart, trust me. People around here still talk about how intimidating you are. Thank you, Aunt Leslie, Margot sniffed. Stan, on the other hand, simply stared at her, frowning and saying nothing. Margot deflated just a little bit more. How disappointing for him to find out the daughter who'd devoted all her time to her career was failing at keeping that career. She knew she shouldn't have said anything in front of him.
"You know what I've learned?" Stan asked.
Margot lifted her head and saw that, yes, it was her father who had just spoken, and not some helpful bystander. "No, Stan. What have you learned?"
"Sometimes life just stinks, like a bass in your couch," Stan said. "It's not fair, and sometimes it doesn't get better. And sometimes there's no reason for it, it just stinks. You can either lean into it and try to ride it out, or you can fold under the weight."
Margot didn't mean to frown at her father. She really didn't. But who was Stan to lecture her on pulling herself up by her bootstraps when he was living in a sleeping cubby at a funeral home? She almost opened her mouth to ask Stan to leave her and Aunt Leslie to discuss the matter. But he followed up with,
"I know I haven't spent much time around you, but I don't think you're a fold-under-the-weight kind of gal. So you misunderstand an email. Big deal. You got embarrassed in front of a bunch of interns. Who cares? In a couple of months, some other catastrophe will catch their attention, and they won't even think about your flamingo problem. You just keep plugging along. You'll be fine."
Margot mulled that over for a moment or two and nodded. "Thank you."
"Well, you don't have to be a smartass about it," Stan snapped.
"No, really. I appreciate it. That was helpful." Stan seemed confused for a moment, like Margot was going to take it back.
"Any time."
Stan didn't smile. There was no affectionate ruffling of her hair as he slid off the stool and carried the huge jug of Leslie's coffee down the dock toward the funeral home. Leslie placed a tall Coke with lots of ice in front of Margot.
"Here, hon. You're looking sort of pale."
Margot took a long draw from the foam cup.
"You sure you're all right?"
Donna asked.
"I just had a conversation with a parent that didn't end in yelling or recriminations," Margot said. "It only took me 30 years.
"Oh, honey. Most people don't get that until they're in their 50s.
Leslie reached over the counter and patted Margot's hand. Margot grinned at her, shaking her head.
"What exactly am I supposed to be eating?"
Margot asked, poking at the large fried dough ball on her plate.
"You know those chocolate cupcakes with the little white swirls on top?"
"You deep-fried a Hostess cupcake?" Margot marveled. Leslie giggled.
"Well, sure. If it works for Twinkies, why not?"
"Prepare yourself," Donna warned her.
Margot pushed her fork through the dough ball, eyes widening as a chocolatey ooze emerged from the center. The first bite was warm and crispy and sweet, like a donut and a hush puppy had a beautiful baby.
"This should not be as good as it is,"
Margot said with a sigh, digging in for a second bite. Leslie smiled brightly.
"See?"
Margot was wary of opening her personal email account for almost a week after the prank interview. She didn't want to be tricked into being an object lesson twice. She wondered if word of her misunderstanding had spread to her former colleagues. Was she even more of a laughingstock than she had been before? Maybe she would end up staying in Lake Sackett long term after all. Her job search was still pretty much at a standstill. But was that such a terrible thing? She was getting used to her little cottage. She was getting used to driving 20 minutes when she forgot milk. The cost of living was low. She had pretty decent job security and a comfortable living situation. She was starting to appreciate her work at the funeral home, bringing order to the chaos that followed death, bringing comfort to people just by handling the little details that were beyond their grasp. And she was making friends. Okay, she was becoming closer with her cousins. She'd established a routine of going to Frankie's cabin on Saturdays for terrible mutant shark movies and fruity drinks. Marianne joined them when she could, but sometimes she called with excuses about the boys' soccer schedule, which Frankie interpreted as sexy times with the hot backwoods hubby. Inevitably, Arlo would find a way to skirt around Frankie's door and snuggle under Margot's arm on the couch. And if she happened to feed him a couple of kernels of popcorn she dropped, it wasn't a gesture of doggy friendship. She just didn't want to waste food. Duffy had managed to talk her onto his boat on a few afternoons when he didn't have charters, but she absolutely refused to fish again. She was content to learn how to drive the pontoon and indulge in a long list of important Oprah-level books she'd always meant to read but never had time to in the city, while Duffy fished and chatted about nothing at all. She'd asked about Lana, the aggressively skanky ex-wife, but Duffy shut her down by offering her sweet tea and a deep-fried Twinkie, and then ignoring the question. She would miss her cousins if she left. She would miss EJJ. She would miss Uncle Bob and Aunt Leslie. Okay, she was still afraid of Aunt Donna, but she would miss that little ripple of fear down her spine when Donna made eye contact. And Tootie. How would she get along without Aunt Tootie being all inspirational and then snarky by turns? Her father. Well, they'd had one nice conversation. That was more progress than either of them had expected. And then there was Kyle. She had no idea what was happening there. Maybe it was a friendship. Maybe it was one of those badly timed flirtations that would never take off. But it didn't feel wrong. Maybe it wouldn't be a fate worse than death, making Lake Sackett her permanent home. When a Saturday night kept Frankie at work, a car wreck involving a local mechanic versus a deer, and Marianne at home, she claimed Nate had a soccer game, but Duffy saw her picking up strawberries and wine at the grocery, Margot decided to drop by Kyle's house. She didn't even use the excuse of planning for the festival, because everything was well in hand, thank you very much. She just wanted to see him, and she wanted him to know that she wanted to see him. Pretense was going to choke the life out of whatever it was between them, and she wasn't going to have it. She was surprised to find him sitting on the end of his dock, watching the September sun sinking into the horizon. The girls were nowhere to be seen, which made her a little uneasy. But she noted that Kyle was drinking a beer, something she guessed he wouldn't do around the kids. And he seemed to be scowling off into the distance. His hunched shoulders and angry expression reminded her of that troubled wraith she'd first met. But now, he wasn't just some fascinating, possible phantom. He was a man with a history she understood. And she wasn't sure if that made it easier or more difficult to see him like this. He didn't move as she walked down the dock, though it was impossible that he missed her footsteps. The sound of crickets chirping was the only noise to compete with her boots against the wood. Margot stood in front of him, offering him the large bottle of Gold City Growler, a local craft beer Duffy had recommended. Kyle reached up to accept it, his brow creased and his eyes lost. "Bad night?" she asked. "Ugh," he said, waggling his hand back and forth. She dropped to her butt, sliding against his side. He leaned his head against her temple. She waited for him to talk, not wanting to rush him, watching the sky turn the water purple and dull. Eventually, he ended up draped bonelessly across her lap as she ran her fingers through his hair. "Want to talk about it?" she asked, cracking open the fresh bottle and taking a short pull. She wasn't much of a beer drinker, or any sort of beer drinker, really, but she could appreciate how the bitter bubbles complemented the setting better than fruity, girly drinks. "I'm confused by you," he muttered against her denim-clad leg. She frowned, but didn't stop stroking his hair. "Because?" "I shouldn't want you. You're fancy and bossy, and you're going to leave town at the first chance you get. I don't think I'm ready for whatever this is. But I want you. I want to see where this goes. I haven't wanted anything like it in a long time, and that makes me feel sort of terrible." "How drunk are you right now?" she asked. "Ugh," he said, sitting up and waggling his hand again. "So this diatribe about you being scared of relationships is based on real feelings and not alcohol?"
"I'm not afraid of relationships. I'm skittish. Don't judge me."
I don't have room to judge anyone about that. I haven't been in a committed relationship in... I don't think I've ever been in a committed relationship. I never had the time, or really the desire. That's sad. Is that sad?